For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Now, this evening we're going to go back to John. We're in John chapter 2. We're going to talk about Jesus' first signs, time permits. Now, we've been calling our series on John, the intimate gospel, around the fact that John arranges his material along three lines. One is he's describing almost like facets in a diamond or sides of a prism, various dimensions of who is Jesus Christ. And then secondly, what has Jesus come to offer? What is the life that he is offering people? And thirdly, what does it look like to respond to him in faith? And as we think through, every chapter really is around these questions, and we're going to come back to this pretty much every week of our study because John is so consistent in orienting his material around these three things. So there is that. We're going to come back to this at the end. We're going to be able to answer some questions. But I love John because it is the intimate gospel. It's conversational. It's relational. It's Jesus moving toward real people in real life situations and just revealing who he is and what he's about. Really hope you enjoyed this study tonight as much as I have in putting it together. Pick it up in John 2, verse 1. He says, "The third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and Jesus' mother was there, and both Jesus and his disciples were invited. When the wine ran out, Jesus' mother said to him, 'They have no wine.' And Jesus said to her," in language that's extremely difficult to translate, "woman," or probably "madam," he's a little bit distant, not mom, "what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." And his mother said to his servants, "Well, whatever he says to you, do it." Now, there were 6 stone water pots set out for the Jewish custom of purification containing 20 or 30 gallons each. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And so they filled them to the brim. And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to him. And when the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom, saying, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then they serve the poorer wine. But you've kept the good wine until now." And then John summarizes the thing, and he says, "This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. And after this, he went to Capernaum with his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and they stayed there a few days." And so here you have the first public event recorded in John's gospel, this miracle of turning water into wine at the wedding of Canaan. And I think in some ways it sort of addresses the preconceptions that people have about Jesus. From medieval art, we have, here's the picture of depicting this event. I don't think they're having any fun. It doesn't look like the kind of party I would want to go to. It's two-dimensional. It's otherworldly. They're not even smiling. Who is this Jesus anyway? I love the way that John describes the kind of engagement that Jesus has with these people at this important time in their life. And that Jesus is giving life to this party. He loves to be where people are. He just joins right in with them in the things that they're about in the course of life. And he participates in life with them. And so in this particular context, it's very interesting to understand the background involved in an ancient Jewish wedding. So in ancient Israel, you know, the most expensive thing you'll ever do is get married. And when a wedding was put on, and Cana is a very small village, maybe several hundred people, maybe as many as a couple thousand people are there, quite a number of the people in town are going to be invited to your wedding because you're part of a community. Everyone's life is interwoven in an important way. And so to become married is to start a new family in this interwoven structure of relationship. And so, so here it is. Jesus is a part of the community in some way. We don't know exactly how, but he's invited, he and his disciples. That's interesting too. A holy man, a rabbi, who people felt comfortable enough to invite into their home to become a part of their deal. And so there it is. And so they're going to put out food. These things last for 7 days. Our wedding party lasted an hour and a half. And people couldn't wait to get out, especially me and my wife. But back then, it was like, this is the highlight of your life. It's the beginning of something new. It's really important. And putting on a good show is a way to welcome people into your new life together, and for the community to welcome this new family into their thing. So in that context, then, there's a big problem, which is that apparently pretty early on in this party, the wine gives out. Well, that's really a drag if you're into a 7-day party. People are going to get really bored. And so, you know, having some wine there, people to relax, to engage, to you know, whatever, that'd be an important thing to do. Certainly that was the custom. And so what we're dealing with here is a situation of extreme embarrassment. Here's this couple who obviously is quite poor. They don't have enough to meet what would be the normal social expectation of a marriage, of a wedding ceremony, of a wedding week in their culture. And it's in that context that Jesus chooses to effect his first sign of his identity. The solution goes like this. He says, there were 6 stone water pots set out for Jewish custom of purification. So there's these large water pots. And they're not there because people are thirsty. They're there so that they can wash themselves. This is a big deal in the first century Jewish world, where protocol, religious protocol, meant a lot. That was a whole kind of idea that underlaid that, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But Jesus talks about this, or Mark does rather, in Mark 7, verses 3 and 4, kind of describes some of the background here. It says that the Pharisees and all the Jews did not eat unless they carefully washed their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And so here's this idea. We're not talking about something that is written into the Bible, that God has not spoken in this area. But by the first century, there were all these traditions made up about hand washing and all manner of other things to keep God's people pure and uncontaminated by the world around them. And so it says when they came from the marketplace, they don't eat unless they cleanse themselves. And there are many other things which they have received in order to observe, such as washing cups and pitchers and pots. And so just all manner of things, whatever interfaces with everyday life, is the subject of things that are contaminated in a ritual sense and therefore must be purified in order to not contaminate the person who is involved with them. Whole rule books of hundreds, literally hundreds of rules in the Talmud, are dedicated to keeping yourself pure. And so, for instance, to breathe air that has been exhaled by a Gentile puts you in an unclean category. It's just remarkable the detail that they go to. But this is what those pots were there for. And out of that, Jesus effects this miracle, which turns that whole thing into wine. How much? 6 stone water pots. How's your math doing here? 20 to 30 gallons each. Okay, so 20 gallons times 6. How much are we talking? 120 gallons at a minimum of wine. Huh? Not liters, gallons. It says gallons. Liters is less. Lots of wine. That's at a minimum. So it's an amazing thing that Jesus has done, really come to bail this embarrassed family out. And apparently it's pretty good stuff, too, because the wine steward, the guy who's sort of in charge of the whole thing, the original party, you know, wedding planner, goes to the groom and says, "You kept the good wine until now." That's not the way it works. You put the good wine out first. And everyone's like, ooh, ah. And then when their tongue is just a little numbed by the good wine that you put out, you put in the Mad Dog or the Boone's Farm or whatever it is, and they're like, you know, no wiser for it because they've, well, whatever. So Jesus in this way, I think, is just doing something on a purely social level that is beautiful. That is that he has regard for the feeling of this family and the role of this family in their broader society. He's willing to move in there and really kind of salvage an embarrassing situation. But there's another dimension to this as well, and this is what we want to focus on here tonight, and which is that John says at the end of this thing, which occurred so subtly, it was, you know, no one really knew except for the disciples what was going on and the ones that had brought in the water, which had turned into wine. So the whole, most of the party was pretty much unaware really of what was happening at all. But John says this, he says this was the beginning of Jesus' signs that he did. And he manifested his glory, and it says his disciples believed in him. So what are we talking about here? John's gospel kind of describes 7 or 8 narratives that surround Jesus performing a sign. In the Greek, it's semeia or semeia. And it's a demonstration of Jesus' identity. The principle is that Jesus does something in the physical world that points to something true in the spiritual world. Sometimes, like this passage we're looking at right now, it's a miraculous thing that Jesus does. He effects a miracle in the physical realm to illustrate something that is true in the spiritual realm. Other times, he's doing signs that are more of a prophetic nature. They're suggestive. They're symbolic of what he has come to do and who he is. They're not necessarily miraculous in that case. But we see, for instance, in Mark's gospel, again in chapter 2, Jesus, in performing an early miracle in Mark's gospel, says of this man who is lame, he says to him, your sins are forgiven. And that created all this scandal among the religious establishment. They're like, you know, who can forgive sins but God alone? You can't just be going around saying, I forgive you. That's the prerogative only God has. And Jesus responds, he says, well, which is it easier to say? Your sins are forgiven, or get up, pick up your pallet, and walk. But, he says, so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to this man, who is the paralytic, I say to you, get up, pick up your pallet, and go home. That's a sign. He's healing this man's body as an evidence, as a proof that he has the authority to heal his soul, to offer him forgiveness. And that's the way signs operate in the Gospels, and certainly they do in the Gospel of John. And in this particular narrative that we're looking at, the wedding in Canaan, John says this is the first sign that Jesus did that manifested his glory or that identified himself for who he is. And so let's delve in a little bit deeper. The sign we're talking about is transforming water into wine, or, as we'll see, transforming the outward elements of religion into a relationship with God. That's the significance of this. Let's think about this from 3 perspectives. Very important feature of who Jesus is. One who has the authority to transform these outward things into something inward and real. About this issue of cleansing, let's think about this. In the religious mindset, the thought is that my failings are basically from pollutants outside myself versus my own inner corruption. You know, what's wrong with me? Well, I'll tell you what's wrong with me. I know you're wrong with me, and you're wrong with me, and this boss is wrong with me, and this family's wrong with me, and these things in my environment are wrong with me, and all these things out there are what's wrong with me. And so if that is the case, then that's going to affect how we think about things. And Jesus, you know, is interacting with a religious group that basically is holding this view, these religious people called Pharisees. And he says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, he says. You are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanliness. And so he's just basically saying that while the religious view is just that the problem is the environment I'm in, it's the society I live in, all of these things, he's saying, no, that's not true. And just to fix the outward appearance doesn't really ever deal with the inner problem that we have. A lot of us, you know, we find ourselves, we struggle in many different ways. And no doubt we have been wronged by other people. He's not saying that we're not victimized by the wicked choices of other people around us, or that there aren't institutions within every society that are just broken, that are not working right, and that do not come alongside people in a just sort of way. He's not denying those things. But what he is saying is that at the heart of the human problem is, in fact, the heart itself. And it's how do I respond to these things around me that began to create these deep grooves in my own heart. I build up a sense of resentment for people who've done me wrong. And now I'm becoming this very kind of person that I'm rebelling against. I remember that so clearly as a young man who, you know, when I was growing up, I had a pretty complicated relationship with my dad. And fair amount of anger actually built up in my heart toward a guy who I thought ought to be playing a certain kind of role in my life that he wasn't. And I had this wake-up call. And when I was 19, I realized sitting alone by myself in a hospital room, I realized, oh my God, I have become the very thing that I loathe. The very thing that I was rebelling against, that's become who I am. It was a very important moment of clarity for me. And I think that this is the kind of thing that God would want all of us to have, is that moment of clarity that says the problems that I have in my life are at the core of it, the ones that are really important, are the ones that are in my heart, not outside of me from the things that other people do to me, the contaminants of my culture, its moral decay, however you may want to label it. And the problem is inside of me. The cancer's within my own heart. And so that's a very different starting place. The religious person is always going to want to say the problem is out there, and therefore it's just easier to stay in my pride, to say that the circumstances are the problem, that other people are the problem. Yeah, I've got an anger problem, and yes, I am really affecting significantly the people around me, but it's not my fault. I mean, if you had the boss that I have or whatever. And that's the religious mentality. It's I stay in my pride. I'm basically okay. But the circumstances I'm in are unjust. The people around me are failing me and influencing me or whatever. And we want to do anything we can other than to look at our own faults and say, you know, my thing is on me. My thing's on me. And that's a place of humility that religious people, almost by definition, don't want to get to. Why? Because a religious person wants to stay in their pride. They want to say, I'm good enough. I can do the right things. I can be acceptable to God if I just follow these prescribed rules. In the first century world of Judaism, that's what it was all about, just following the rules, keeping myself from being contaminated. And this superficial view of the problems that we have leads also to a very superficial solution, the religious solution that was really the solution that Jesus in this miracle is subtly but truly speaking to. Isaiah puts it like this in the Old Testament. He says, these people draw near with their words and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me, and their reverence for me consists of traditions learned by rote. And so, yeah, that's what it is. You know, basically we minimize the evil in my own heart. We externalize the problem, saying that it's out there. And then we basically are prepared to say, as a religious person, we're prepared to say, well, you know, just if I keep myself unstained from these elements, then I'm going to be doing okay. I'm going to be all right. And a part of that then is taking on rituals and formulas of various kinds that express my piety, that show that I'm really serious about the things of God. I'm sure that God would be deeply impressed by these things. But no, he's not. You know, religion has always been about these formulas that people just, you can say them all you want, and they're just, you can be thinking about something completely different the whole time. One of the greatest kind of pictures of this, I think, is the prayer that almost every person in Christian America has learned to pray from the very earliest times, which begins with, you got it. It's so interesting that prayer is prefaced by Jesus teaching his disciples how to pray. And he says, pray like this. And we turn that into, no, pray this. As though somehow it's just uttering these words has this magical spiritual value of making us pleasing to God and somehow in a better state morally or spiritually than we were than before we uttered it. And so Christians, you know, in our own culture are not that different really from the Jews of the first century world. We're not that different at all. And in fact, religion all over the world kind of works by these formulaic expressions, these rituals and rites that we can do mechanically, often without even thinking about them. You know, how many times of day we pray, the posture that we take, all of these kinds of things religion just loves to put out there because it gives us that false sense that we're really serious about the things of God. And yet how strange it is. Why would you ever relate to a person through memorized, repeated formulas? God is a person. Okay, he has a will, he has affections, he's able to relate to you and to me. We've been saying this as we've been looking at the study of John, that God is a relational God. He's the intimate, this is the intimate gospel. And yet why would we relate to God through formulas? You know, some of us are married. I've been married now for three decades. What if during the three decades of our marriage, the sum total of my communication with my wife was, I love thee. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. One, blah, blah, blah. Two, yakety yak. You know, and just kind of go through the thing. You know, I think my wife is very perceptive. And I think that she would sense very early on, this guy's not sincere at all. He's just pushing some button, some play button in his head, and these words are coming out, but where his head's at, who knows? It's just too weird. And we begin to think as well. Here's a person who can't relate to me on real terms, that I don't know their heart. They're unwilling to kind of, you know, put that out before me like in any other relationship. I wonder what is it that they're trying to avoid. And the religious person is, in fact, trying to avoid. They're trying to put forth their piety, their ritual observances, all of these things as substitutes for something that is going on in the heart, because it is, at the end of the day, all about our relationship with God. It's a relational thing. And so God's solution addresses just exactly this, a coming revolution within. And that this miracle of turning the water to wine sort of points the direction in that. It's the fulfillment of this whole body of prediction in the Old Testament among the prophets. Ezekiel puts it this way. He says, I will give them one day a heart, a new heart, and I'll put a new spirit within them. And I'll take away their heart of stone and their heart of out of their flesh and give them a heart of flesh. I'm going to give them something new, something that's real, not this stony heart that just approaches me on the basis of some sort of ritualistic thing. The gospel, the good news that Jesus brings, is not some manner of getting my life together, of doing the right thing, of appearing better than the next guy, of really being observant. He's not talking about improvement at all. The gospel is not about improvement. It is about something that happens inwardly. You drink wine. We're made new, not better. Jesus is going to really lay this out in the next chapter, in chapter 3, in his conversation with Nicodemus. In a lot of ways, this narrative right here is just paving the way for that intimate conversation that's going to happen. So there's the inward versus the external that this sign evidences about who Jesus is, what he's come to give. Second is the fact that wine symbolizes joy and the life of God. In the Old Testament, again, which is the thought world of Jesus as he's doing these things, and that's clearly how he's being interpreted as well, wine plays prominently in how God resolves human history. In Isaiah 25, the Lord of hosts, he says, will prepare a lavish banquet for all people on this mountain. This is in Jerusalem. A banquet of aged wine. I wonder if it's as good as the wine at the wedding at Cana. I don't know. Choice meats with marrow. And by the way, did I say refined aged wine? He said, so he, that is God, will swallow up death for all time, and the Lord will wipe away tears from all faces, and he will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth. This is what's coming, folks. This is what God is promising. He's promising this a time where he comes and he's going to be fully involved ruling the earth. And that's a sweet time. It's a party. He's describing here a banquet, just like the wedding in Cana, sort of a snapshot of the movie that's going to come. You know, in the Jewish culture, they pull out a glass of wine and they say, L'chaim, to life. Because why? Because wine represents life and the goodness of life that God's given. It's like Psalm 103 says, bless the Lord, O my soul, and may I never forget the good things he's done for me. I like that. May I never forget the good things that he's done for me. What has he done for me? He forgives my sins completely. He heals my diseases. He redeems me from death and crowns me with love and tender mercy. He fills my life with good things. Man, if you're having difficulty in your life, you're not sensing that reality of God's involvement with you, a sense of joy that comes with that. Here's how we address that issue. We come back to God, we lift our glass, and we say, may I never forget, God, your incredible forgiveness and the great price that you were willing to pay to secure it. You forgave me all of the things that are offensive to you, not because I washed my hands the right way or uttered the right formula or said the right things, but because you in your gracious generosity came and you took upon yourself the burden of my guilt. You died the death I deserved to offer me forgiveness for all of my sins, he says. I'll drink to that. You? You bet. He heals my diseases. You know, he's prepared to move into our lives to affect real and substantive change. There come a time, that's true, when we'll be wholly restored. No evidence left of the stain of sin in our bodies. I look forward to that day. But it is also true, as the psalmist says, even here, that he's involved in our lives in the present, working toward that end. And we can come to him in our brokenness. And we can raise our glass and say, L'chaim to life. Why? Because you care about my broken life. And as I pour my heart out to you, I can expect that there will be healing there, that you will, as you see fit, and in your way, you will respond to these things in my life. He redeems me from death. He bought me out of the death that I deserve. He crowns me. He doesn't just begrudgingly accept me. Well, I guess because I died for you, y'all have to let you in, but you really grossed me out. No, he says, he crowns me with love and tender mercy. Look at the verb tense. Not that he will crown me with love and tender mercy. It's past tense. It's or present tense. He crowns me with love and tender mercy. No matter where you are here tonight as his child. And maybe you've drifted very far from where he would have you be. And you know that that's true. The way to come back is not to make yourself better and to do the right thing. The way to come back is to recognize that even now where I am, he loves me. And that he treats me with tender mercy. He offers me his grace. It's grace that changes people's lives, not religion, not observances, not moral effort. It's standing in that place where we are willing to receive from God again that reminder of his undying love for you, his unending love for you. That's the place to start. And to remember finally that he fills my life with good things. God's blessed you beyond what you can imagine. I think about this in my own life. Last year, we had this reunion from my high school. I forget how many years it was. It was a whole bunch of years. I'm too old to remember now. I hadn't seen some of these people in almost 40 years. And a handful of us, we were pretty tight. And, you know, we got together and I realized, here are some friends of mine who were dear to me at this time of my life who went this direction. And by his mercy, God brought me into this other direction over here. And, you know, just to be able to see men who were much like me, unable to sustain a human relationship, both of them living, my closest friends living completely isolated lives by themselves. On multiple acres of rural land, just away, as you know, they definitely turned on and tuned in and dropped out. And that was me. But that's not me. Why? Because God is in the mix. God's in the picture. And he has filled my life with good things. How about you? What are the good things that God has filled your life with? You know, and these are the things then that I just think are so important for us. That's what this whole imagery of the external to the internal, the whole symbolic significance of wine, that's what these things mean about who is God, what's his intent. And lastly, and you know, ironically, I suppose, Jesus begins his public ministry in John chapter 2 at a wedding feast and in some ways just kind of anticipates where this whole thing is going. I love the scene at the close of the Bible in Revelation chapter 19 where it says, let us rejoice and be glad. Let us rejoice and be glad and give the glory to him. For the marriage of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready. It was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean. And that, who is the bride? You are the bride. We are the bride of Christ as his people. And he has made us bright and clean. And he is the Lamb who is wedded to us forever. This imagery could not be more intimate. What is God's intent for you? God's intent is to have a permanent relationship with you that endures forever. That's what God has for you. And just the imagery itself represents this great affection that he has for you. It doesn't matter where you've been. It doesn't matter how well or how poorly you stack up relative to somebody else. None of that stuff matters. What matters is that he loves you. God loves you. And that God is calling you into a relationship that can only be described in the intimacy and the commitment that we experience in marriage. And that's God's intent for you. And that is an awesome thing. It's awesome. Either it's complete fantasy and absurdity, or it is a picture of amazing love. Amazing love. I opt for the second. I think that's the reality of it, is that that is who God is, and that is the very intent of God for you. Sweet. So that's the significance, as I see it, and as I think most commentators do, of this first sign. And I want to very briefly review the second sign, because they come as a pair, and they together set up the conversation that's going to happen in chapter 3 that we'll talk about next time we meet. In verse 13, it says that the Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and money changers seated at the tables. Jesus made a scourge of cords and drove them out of the temple with the sheep and oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And so here, in the last narrative, we've got a really kind, sensitive Jesus just really doing the miraculous to avoid, so that poor people can avoid shame, social shame. Now we've got something very different in mind. Is it this? This is a medieval picture of the cleansing of the temple. It's like, is he dancing? I can't tell what he's doing there. It doesn't look too scary, though. But that's not the picture that John gives us. John is like, you know, here's this guy, he goes into the temple, and all these animals are running out the door. These heavy tables of money changers being overturned, coins spreading all over the place. This is not gentle Jesus. This is Jesus getting down on some things that he's really unhappy about. And it's a real display of anger, not whatever that is. Then it says in verse 16, to those selling doves, he said, take these things away. Stop making my Father's house a place of business. And his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. That's a prophecy right out of the book of Zechariah. The Jews then said to Jesus, what sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things? And Jesus answered, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. What's the sign? Verse 20, the Jews said to him, well, yeah, it took 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it up in 3 days? Yeah, right. But he says he was speaking of the temple of his body. So when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered he said this, and they believed the scriptures and the word which Jesus had spoken. So this is, again, it's a parallel to the sign that we just looked at. So whereas Jesus is the party animal in the first, he's the party crasher in the second. And the setting is in the temple. And the temple business is what he is objecting to. The whole temple's going on there. You got the priest class, and they are officiating their temple business. They are buying sacrificial animals, and they are and selling them to the people at a price. You know, think about this: if you're the priest and it's your job to determine what animal is worthy of sacrifice and what isn't, then it doesn't take you very long to realize, I bet there's a profit in this. And this is exactly, of course, what they were doing. And so out back behind the temple is their herd of amazingly uncorrupted, unspotted, unblemished animals. I don't know how they did it, but it's pretty amazing. And so this person would maybe walk hundreds of miles to Jerusalem to offer up this once-in-a-lifetime sacrifice of this animal, as prescribed in the Old Testament law, and the priest there would be like, yeah, well, see this under the underbelly there, see that little thing? That's called a blemish, and that's not going to work. Did you get insurance? No? Okay, well, you've got a real problem then. But I have a solution. You can trade in this old junker for a clean, unblemished animal, and it will only cost you, well, a whole lot more than what you paid for that thing. And so they had this thing going on, and these priests were becoming quite wealthy, in fact, to the great anger of the people. They realized, man, we're being screwed by these guys. There's nothing we can do. It's just as we might as well just give whatever we've got, because they extort everything we have anyhow. And so they are painting this whole picture of what it means to approach God that is just as bizarre as this hand-washing thing we talked about in the last episode. And so Jesus, in seeing the hypocrisy of this symbolic act of offering an innocent animal to substitute for the death of the guilty, that's what the whole sacrificial system is all about, being corrupted and bastardized by the lust for money, and to put a price tag in that sense on people's soul, it just inflamed him. And so he goes in there and he just kind of goes ballistic in the temple. And it's interesting in the narrative, it never says that the people were like incensed or they couldn't believe that this was happening. Of course, Jesus was very much expressing the hypocrisy that everyone knew was true about the temple in his day. But the important thing here is, and this is what we want to end with, is in verse 21, it says he was speaking of the temple of his body when he says, tear this temple down and in 3 days I will rebuild it. This is the second sign. He cleanses the temple because the temple comes to represent his own body. So Jesus, in this sense then, is the true temple. And that means something important because the temple represents the very presence of God. That's what temples are there for. It's sacred ground. It's like, this is where we meet God, in this place. And Jesus said, that's my body. That's the presence of God, my body, by the way, which as the Lamb of God, I'm just going to offer to everybody. And so through Jesus, then, God's sanctuary is not some building, some place, but God's sanctuary, God's temple is in our midst. And this then ends up being a very rich part of the whole understanding of the Christian message and of the Christian community. Peter puts it like this. In 1 Peter 2, he says, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people of God's own possession. That's taken right out of the book, of Exodus in the Old Testament. And then he says, so that you may proclaim the excellent things of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. And here Peter is saying, you know, we are like the temple of God. We are the body of Christ. He resides in us through his Spirit. We don't have to go to a place to meet God. God has met us as we've responded to the gospel and come into our lives. And we've got that fellowship going on with him, that intimate connection with him. That's where the presence of God is. And collectively then, when we come together as God's people, he is present also in our midst. And that is a sweet thing. That means that this is a supernatural moment. God is with us here tonight. God is appealing to your heart, even as you sit and participate in this study. God is here. God is trying to connect the concerns of your heart and where you are with the truth of his word. And he's trying to say, "You come to me. Respond to me. You don't have to go someplace to find me. I'm here. And I'm just asking you to, in the quietness of your heart, to open yourself up to me. Let me teach you. Let me comfort you. Let me forgive you. Let's appreciate the presence of God. So these signs end up being really important. Water to wine, symbolizing Jesus' transformation of religion into relationship. The cleansing of the temple, symbolizing the true nature of Jesus' presence in the world. His presence even with us here tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.